We have spent 3 weeks now unpacking Jesus' teaching on love. You get it in all three of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And in each of the gospels, the story's told a little bit different, but the point's always essentially the same. Excuse me. Jesus is teaching us what is necessary for the good life and what is necessary for us to be happy, because all of us actually are chasing that. We all want to be happy. And Jesus is just telling us how we get that done. And what he does is he summarizes all of the Old Testament law in just a handful of commands. He says, you want to be happy? Well, then love the Lord your God. Everything you got, heart, soul, mind, strength. Augustine tells us that our problem is not that we don't have love. We certainly have it. It's that our loves are disordered. We don't have them in the right order, and we emphasize some things that we love far too much, and other things that we should love more, we love not enough. And our problem usually is that God's not at the center of it all, and the full weight of our love isn't leaning into him. And in fact, that's why a lot of us are unhappy. Because if we actually leaned into that, if we actually loved God more than we loved anything else, and if we really love God the way that we should, I think what we would find is that we'd actually be much happier, because God's the only thing in the whole universe that when you got him, you can't lose him. Can't be taken away from you. And he never, ever disappoints. You seek satisfaction in him, you will never be cheated. It's a good life. Second command goes along with the first. You got to love your neighbor. And you have to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Though, as we saw last week, that's a little easier said than done, because in truth, many of us don't really love ourselves the way that we should, that we ought. And the remedy to that is actually to know how God loves you. And he loves you a lot. Because when you understand how God loves you, then you will know how to love yourself. Then you will know how to love your neighbor as you should. Love God, love your neighbor the way you love yourself. Now, when Jesus is teaching all this, I'm sure there are people that are kind of sitting there like, all right, Jesus, we've heard that, because they had. I mean, this is not teaching that's original to Jesus, by the way. He's just saying it because it's true. There were lots of other rabbis that were teaching the same sort of thing. They looked at the Old Testament, and they'd summarize all the rules and the commands the same way Jesus did. Love the Lord your God, and love your neighbor. And people are thinking, Jesus, we got that. What's so special about your teaching? And Jesus tells them in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, sure, well, of course you've heard this. You have all heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Because that is what they had all heard. That was the teaching. Love God, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. And in that sort of framework, the lawyer's question that we looked at 2 weeks ago makes a lot of sense. Well, okay, who is my neighbor? Because now it matters to decide who's my neighbor and who's my enemy. Because there's some people that you have to love and some you don't. But Jesus says, you've heard it taught that way, but I say to you, love your enemies. And pray for those who persecute you. Well, Jesus, why would we want to do that? So that you may be sons and daughters of your Father who is in heaven. You want to be daddy's kid? You got to love your enemies. For he makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good. And he sends the rains for those who deserve it and those who don't. And if you only love those who love you, what reward do you think you're going to get? And don't even the tax collectors do that? And if you greet only your brother, what more are you doing than others? Don't even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, must be perfect, complete, mature, as your heavenly Father is perfect. See, the challenge of being a child of God is that you're called to be just like your daddy. That's hard. The problem's not that we don't love our enemies, that we don't like them. I mean, that's a problem, but we all kind of come by that naturally in this fallen state, right? And that's why we call them our enemies. Nobody likes their enemies. I think our problem might also be that we don't like the love that the Father has for them. But if we want to be his kids, we've got to be like him. And I think that's what we all want, isn't it? That's what we ended with, ended our service with last week. We ended with the parable of the prodigal son. It's that story of the younger of two brothers goes to his dad and he says the unimaginable. He goes to his dad and in essence says, I can't wait for you to die so that I can get my inheritance. Now understand, if this actually happened in Jewish culture, no father would ever give the inheritance to the son. Like that was not a practice. You just threw the son out of the house. I can't wait for you to die so I can get what's coming to me. I want it now. Not interested in relationship. I want your stuff. And incredibly, the father gives it to him. And a few days later, he collects all that's his and he goes off to a foreign country and he burns through all of it. Foolishly. And wild and reckless living. And when he runs out of money, he runs out of friends and he runs out of connections. And then a famine comes and he's got nothing. And so he hires himself out to a farmer to feed his pigs, but he's not even making enough to buy what the pigs are eating. It's an incredible statement about the value and worth of the son. The farmer doesn't see his life as any more valuable than his pigs. And in his extreme desperation, he finally comes to himself. He's like, what am I doing? At least the servants of my father's house have food. So I'll humble myself, admit that I was wrong, go home and say, Dad, I'm not worthy to be called your son anymore. I know that. At least let me be one of the hired hands who has food to eat. And he comes home, probably full of just fear and shame. He wants to know, like so many of us do, if the father's going to welcome him back. Or is he going to kick him to the curb? And the father sees him a long way off and he jumps up off the porch and he runs out to him. And understand, Jewish men don't run. It's not dignified, but this father doesn't care. It's his boy, and so he runs out and the son doesn't even get all the way through his apology before the father wraps his arms around him. And he embraces him and he kisses him and he puts a new robe on him and a ring on his finger and he kills the fattened calf. He says, welcome home. I love you. All is forgiven. I think that's what we want. Deep in our soul, that's what we desire. We want to know that we are sons and daughters of our Father. We're so desperate for this. And I said last week that my hope is that that can be a passage that you can come home to and rest in. And when all the voices in your head tell you that you're unworthy and you'll never be good enough and you've done too many things wrong, you'll be able to hear the truth of what God says about his love. But I should also have given you a warning. Because if you come to this passage, you will hear the truth about God's love. Can I finish the story for you this morning? The younger son comes home, the father embraces him, they begin to celebrate. Verse 25. Now his older brother was in the field. And as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants and asked, what do these things mean? And he said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. But the older brother was angry, and he refused to go in. The father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, look, these many years I've served you. I've never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this, your son, comes back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you kill the fattened calf for him. And the father said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. And it was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. We call this the story of the prodigal son, but the truth is it's actually about two sons. And both of them are lost. The younger son gets lost when in his foolishness he goes off to a foreign country to pursue his lustful desires and to live the life he thinks is going to bring satisfaction. The older brother, he never leaves home. He doesn't even leave the field, and yet you can hear the anger and the resentment and the bitterness. And the older son, he never left, but he's no less lost. He never left the field, but he was never really at home either. I used to read this story and think that it was about two types of people. That makes sense given the context of Luke chapter 15. Luke chapter 15 is all about stories Jesus is telling about lost things being found. Coins, sheep, sons, right? The way it begins is that these Pharisees, these religious elite, these rule followers, people who always did the right thing, they come to Jesus and they begin to give him a hard time because he's eating with sinners. And in this culture, the person you sit down and eat with, that's like the highest form of association. You're telling everybody else something about yourself based on who you eat with. And the Pharisee said a good teacher, a righteous rabbi, would never sit down with those sorts of people. And so Jesus begins telling these stories. And so I thought the younger son and the older son are two types of people. You've got one that understands that they're sinful. They know how broken they are, and they are willing to humble themselves, and they come back, and the Father embraces them. That's the younger son, and he kind of represents the tax collectors and the sinners and the prostitutes that Jesus likes to hang out with. And then you have the older son, and he's kind of the type of the Pharisees, these really stuffy religious people who are self-righteous and impressed with what they've done, and they really look down with disdain on the sinners. And I used to think these are two types of people, and you've got to figure out which one you are. And the obvious answer is you want to be the humble one who knows it's wrong, right? That might be the case. But again, I'm reading this passage a little differently. I recently read a book called The Return of the Prodigal Son. It's by Henry Nouwen. And this is his reflections on this parable and on a painting by Rembrandt called The Return of the Prodigal Son. It's on the cover and on his own spiritual journey. And this is one of the most spiritually insightful books I've read in a long time. And after I read this, I'm starting to think a little differently about this passage. Maybe it's not two types of people, two categories, but maybe it's two sides of the same soul. Of my soul. Because there's certainly days where I'm the younger brother. There's certainly days where my problem is the shame that I feel for all the terrible things that I've done. And I'm so aware of it, and I know I'm not worthy. And my problem is that my shame keeps me from running back to the Father because I'm afraid He's not going to embrace me. But there's also days where I'm the older son. My problem's not shame. My problem's my self-righteousness for all the good things that I've done. Shame and self-righteousness in me at the same time. The older brother's lost. But this sort of lostness is hard to see. It's hard to put your finger on because it grows up in the fields of our obedience. Remember, he doesn't leave. It's the sort of lostness that you find in the midst of trying to do the right thing. In the very place that you're trying to practice righteousness, you get lost. Henry Nouwen describes it this way, it's as if something gets attached to the underside of our virtue. Do you know what this is like? For me, it happened this way in college. It was on the weekends. My friends would go out to movies that I did not approve of. I grew up in a pretty conservative Christian home, so I had this kind of natural bend this way, but I would look at movies and say, you know, that sort of content doesn't need to be put into my mind. And they would go, and I was left alone in the dorm. Me and my righteousness. I was lonely. And I was angry. It's what happens when you don't get invited to the parties that all your friends go to because they know you don't want to drink the way they want to drink. The frustration you feel when you cry out to God and you're like, God, am I the only Christian saving sex for marriage? I know that's what your word teaches. Am I the only one? Because, man, it seems like all the other Christians are doing it too. Am I the only one? Why am I denying myself something that everybody else seems to be enjoying with no consequences? Is it just me trying to do the right thing? It's frustration that just kind of gets to you when you look around at all the people who are cheating. I mean, they're cheating on their taxes, they're cutting corners, they're working the system, but man, they're driving a new car. And I'm trying to do things the straight and honest way. I'm driving a clunker. It's when your company doesn't compete as well as other companies because you care about people. They don't. They care about the bottom line. They're not worried about who they run over. They're not worried about who they hurt. And so they have a competitive edge in the marketplace that you don't have because they're willing to do things you're not willing to do because you care too much. It's when you go to work and you're the sort of person that you show up on time because it's right. And you work hard because it's right. And you care about the company and the quality of the product that you produce because these things are just right. And then you've got a coworker right next to you. He's always 5 minutes late, but he writes in on his timesheet that he was on time. And everybody knows it. The boss never addresses it. He's not there for the company. He's not there for the quality of the product. He's there for a paycheck. He's just passing the time. And half the time, you're fixing mistakes that he made. And when he gets a raise, you get a raise, you're making the same, and the boss has never once come to you and said, thank you, you do good work, attaboy, we value you, we appreciate you, what you do matters. It's a frustration when you're trying to navigate the difficulties of human relationships and you're really, really trying to show the love of God. And so when you're in conflict with people, you don't raise your voice, you don't name call, you don't slander them, you don't curse. You really try and listen and hear their heart, but it seems that all you've earned yourself is them dominating the conversation because it's easy. It's like you don't fight back. You're trying to be loving and it makes it easier for them to abuse you. And when we're in those places, wherever that is in your life, I think we tell ourselves just to get by that there's got to be a day of reckoning. There has got to be a day where all of this shakes out, where finally justice is done and people actually start to see other people for who they really are. That the wicked and the cheats and the liars, they're all found out. And there's got to be a day coming where people will look at me and at my body of work and say, you did good. That was right. You were right, and all of us know it. Good job. That day ain't tomorrow. And it's probably not going to be this week. And what I think happens in this space in between here and wherever that place is, something wells up in our heart that we would never say out loud, but is there. It's jealousy. It's envy. For all the people who seem to just do what they want and have a really good time of it. And you won't. Or you can't. Nouwen describes this place pretty well. says, "All my life I've harbored a strange curiosity for the disobedient life that I myself didn't dare to live, but which I saw being lived by many around me. I did all the proper things, mostly complying with the agendas set by the many parental figures in my life, teachers, spiritual directors. But at the same time, I often wondered why I didn't have the courage to run away as the younger son did. It's strange to say this, but deep in my heart, I've known the feeling of envy towards the wayward son. It's the emotion that arises when I see my friends having a good time doing all sorts of things that I condemn. I call their behavior reprehensible or even immoral, but at the same time, I often wonder why I didn't have the nerve to do some of it or all of it myself. The obedient and dutiful life of which I am proud or for which I am praised feels sometimes like a burden that was laid on my shoulders, and it continues to oppress me even when I've accepted it to such a degree that I cannot throw it off. I have no difficulty identifying with the elder son of the parable who complains, 'All these years I have slaved for you and never once disobeyed any of your orders, yet you never offered me so much as a young goat for me to celebrate with my friends.' In this complaint, obedience and duty have become a burden, and service has become slavery." You have never once given me a young goat to celebrate with my friends, in spite of all I've done for you. See, this is the place in our heart where envy turns the corner and it becomes resentment. It's this place of deep hurt and deep complaint where we cry out to God, "I have never gotten what I deserved for all the good I did. No praise, no recognition, no reward, no trophy, no pat on the back, no goat." And what you find, or what you find out, is how angry you are. It's not just the goat. It's that this son of yours, notice he doesn't say my brother, this son of yours, the reckless one, the wicked one, he goes out, he burns through everything in a sinful life, he comes back a wretch, and instead of giving him what he deserves, you give him what he doesn't deserve. You gave him the fattened calf. Our calf. That thing that we were working on, that special thing that we've been saving for the right moment to celebrate. And you took it, you didn't give it to me, you gave it to him. Last straw. It's not fair. You see, you find out that you don't just resent your brother, but now you discover that you resent your father too, and the way that he loves. Because it's not fair. There have been times in my life, in my spiritual journey, where I felt distant from God. And this is not uncommon. You read the old great spiritual autobiographies by the saints, and they describe the same sorts of things. Periods in your life where God just feels far away. That's not uncommon, but there's been times in my life that I would describe this way, as if the love of God was just not felt in my heart. And in those times, I would imagine myself to be the younger son, and I would say, "God, I want to come home to you, and I want to feel your love, and I want to feel your embrace, God, and I want to know that you love me, because right now I don't feel your love in my heart." And I'd say, "If I'm willing to come, where are you at? Because I read the story, and I know that God always runs out to us." What I'm beginning to discover is more often than not in those places, I'm not actually being the younger son. I'm stepping into the shoes of the older one. And my problem isn't shame, it's resentment. It's this deep resentment and this anger that keeps me from going into the house. But because I'm so angry, I miss what the father does. Do you notice in the story, it doesn't matter which son we're talking about, the father always goes out to them. The younger son comes home, the father goes out running. The older son refuses to enter into the father's joy and celebration and welcome, and so the father comes out. He's hosting a party. In this culture, the host never leaves. But the father comes to the older son. Because the father is always seeking what is lost. And he begins to entreat his son. He pleads with him. He begs him, come into the party. Enter into the welcome. Enter into the joy. And the older son, like me, just stands there with his arms crossed. And what I found is so many times in my own life, it's not that God's not calling me into the party. And it's not that God hasn't come to me. It's that I'm standing aloof in my resentment, refusing to enter into his welcome. My arms are crossed so I cannot be embraced. There's nothing wrong with God's love. What's wrong is me. I'm the one blocking God's love out of my life. Because I feel that I've earned it. Look at all my obedience, God. Don't you owe me some sense of love in my heart? Shouldn't I be feeling these sorts of things right now? I mean, look, God, I'm a pastor after all. I answered your call to ministry. I went off to school. I gave up a lot of different things I could have done that aren't this. So I could serve you. Don't you owe me something? Do you know what the problem with resentment is? Keeps you outside. Resentment doesn't let you go into the party. Resentment won't allow you to enter into the joy of God. The joy of His love. It keeps you outside and it keeps you lonely. And it keeps you angry. And what inevitably happens is that when you're standing outside with your arms crossed and you hear the joy of others who are in the party, that joy becomes fuel for a fire that burns terribly inside you. Joy and resentment do not reside in the same human heart at the same time. You have to choose what you're going to hold on to and what you're going to keep, because you can't have both. You can't have this overwhelming sense of how unfair it is that God loves everybody in extravagant and unreal ways and still participate in His love, still participate in His joy, and feel God's embrace. You can't have both. The way Jesus tells the story, the Father has the last word, and we don't really know how it ends. We don't know if the older son goes in or stays out. I wonder if he tells the story this way because it's really an invitation for us. It's a call to decision. I hope the older son goes in. I hope we do. And maybe we will if we can hear the words of the Father that we so desperately need to hear. He says, son, you are always with me. Son, daughter, you are always with me. That's what matters. It was never about the property. It was never really about the inheritance, the fields, the house, the goats, the cat. It wasn't ever about that. It was about being with the Father. That's what's so great about working in the fields of obedience and righteousness. Not that you've earned something by being faithful in that place, but because you're in that place, you get to be with your dad. You get to work side by side with them. And you don't have to earn anything. You just get to be with him because he's always with you. But when we get focused on the field, the inheritance, and that comparison game where we think about how we've acted versus how our brothers acted and what we deserve and what he's gotten, we can be standing right next to the Father and be 1,000 miles away from him. Son, you are always with me. And I'm with you. And have you forgotten? I mean, if you're still hung up on the stuff, have you forgotten that everything I have is yours? What's a goat between us? All the goats that are mine are yours, and all the calves and all the houses and all the fields, everything I have, it's yours. And you're always with me. Man, if we miss that, we've missed everything. So if we're wrestling with resentment today, what in the world do we do about it, and how in the world do we get out of it? In truth, I don't think we get out on our own. The Father has to do it. But there are some postures I think we can take in our life. And the first one is trust. You have to just trust the love of God. You're not always going to understand it because it's more extravagant than you can imagine and it's more forgiving than you'll ever be. But you got to find a way to trust the love of God. Trust is one of those ways that we uncross our arms and we open ourselves up for the embrace of God. And that's what you need. You want your cold heart to melt, you open your arms up and you let the Father hold you until the warmth of his love melts the resentment in your heart. But you only get to that place when you open up and say, God, I'll trust you. I'll trust your love. I need that, God. And if we want resentment to leave, we have to find a way back to gratitude. A place where we can look at our lives, however they've come to us, and recognize that all of life is a gift. However it came to you, the life you've got today is a gift. The sun came up and it's a gift. There's breath in your lungs and it's a gift. And God is right there next to you if you'll open your eyes and be with him, and it's a gift. And all that he has is yours, and it's a gift. It's just a better way to live. Because when you're busy being grateful and thankful for all the gifts that you have and the gift that life is, you're too busy to play the comparison game. There's no room for envy that, when it's planted and given time, grows into resentment. There's just no place for it anymore. The fields of your heart are full. Church, that's the invitation this morning. The Father's come out of the house to us. Won't you come in? Will you enter into my welcome and my joy and my love and the celebration of all that is lost, that is being found? Won't you come in? There's no place for your resentment, but I'll give you joy instead. Wouldn't you rather have that this morning?